Welcome to What's Next for ASP. I am Matthew Wallen. I'm guest hosting today as Maggie Feldman-Pilch is out. Today we have Aidan Dobkin. Aidan is a consultant focusing on military and national security policy and communications. He's an adjunct fellow of ASP whose writing is primarily focused on military strategy and innovation efforts within the national security community. Aidan is also director of the Military Writers Guild, an international coalition of service members, veterans, civilian analysts, and writers dedicated to the heightening national security discourse through the written word. Aidan tweets at Aidan Dobkin. Aidan, you're here to talk about space with us today.
I am indeed. Thanks for having me on, Matt.
So space and national security, give us an overview. How does this apply to the national security discourse?
Sure. So I generally think of kind of the unsexy elements of space, which are kind of the most important nowadays in conflict, but also then kind of the keystone projects from an international cooperative standpoint, so with diplomacy and things of that nature. But really, what we're talking about when we're talking about conflict in space is capabilities related to communications, weather prediction, imaging, things of that nature, which have kind of remained constant but iterative efforts over the past decades since the Cold War, essentially.
All right. So are we talking about things like Star Wars, or are we talking more something a little less, should we say, a little less sexy, as you should say, as you said?
Yeah. So I generally fall in the viewpoint that most of the efforts that are most important in space and will be for future conflicts as well are really those kind of inane methods. Both from a defensive or passive standpoint, using the terminology of our international treaties, so related to reconnaissance and things of that nature. Even if we were to see some of the kind of cooler elements that are more Star Wars-esque, really, I fall on the standpoint that the most effective ones in that method would be kind of really, once again, inane. They're, you know, capabilities in relating to destruction of satellites and things like that.
Right.
You see some people talking about space-based lasers and things of that nature, but really I think those are kind of shooting for the moon, and I apologize for the pun, but in terms of our space-based capabilities, really the most effective ones are kind of the simple ones that don't garner as much attention.
So you talk about destroying satellites. So, I mean, can you elaborate on that? What exactly is the process of destroying a satellite, and why would anybody want to do that?
Sure. So the reason why one would want to destroy a satellite is both for tactical or strategic purposes. On the tactical level, you see, even nowadays, related to things like weather, interruptions in terms of communications and imaging technologies. I'm blanking on the specific incident, but recently in Afghanistan, we had a really tragic incident with a number of service members who died, partially as a function of a disruption in our imaging and weather-based capabilities, which we relied on space-based elements for. From a strategic standpoint, the reason why one would want to destroy a satellite is for things like the disruption of early warning technologies, which are primarily based in geosynchronous orbit above the Earth. And that is granted a much more extreme view, and one that would really only occur in a major symmetric great powers conflict, but it's nonetheless a reason why one would want to take out a satellite. In terms of how one would go about that, there are a number of ways. There are Earth-based elements like anti-satellite missiles, which China, Russia, the United States have all tested. A missile that is launched from a plane at a high altitude, which can go into low Earth orbit and just take out a satellite. Now, you have to have a very targeted approach in that sense. I don't think from a strategic standpoint it would have much of a factor, but myself, along with a number of much more prominent defense thinkers, that think that in any symmetric conflict in the 21st century, space is going to have an effect, and asymmetric as well. Asymmetric in the sense that we're using space-based elements for reconnaissance and things like that, once again. Symmetric in the sense that space could become a battlefield of sorts, at least autonomously, in terms of taking out tactical and strategic-based elements.
Now, when you talk about, you know, symmetric versus asymmetric, you know, one of the things that comes to mind to me is that maybe taking out a satellite tends to be more of an asymmetric method of warfare, because if you've got your own satellites and you're destroying them, you're certainly creating a lot of debris and you risk damaging your own equipment. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So there's been a lot of talk about the buildup of space-based elements. Are we going to reach a point in which we simply have too many elements in space to properly prepare for risks that could damage our own satellites? You know, whether someone takes out a satellite, as you mentioned, and the debris kind of floats around and really, you know, causes some major disruptions.
A la gravity.
Right. I don't think that is of the biggest import. I think that, you know, one, space is really big, which seems overly simplified, but it really is. And I think the effects of particularly a targeted element taking out a satellite and then having debris, it's something that you shouldn't just dismiss outright.
Right.
But I don't think it's of the biggest consequence. And when I talk about symmetric, I mean between two kind of great powers, essentially,
right,
versus the United States in the war against ISIS or something like that. So, yeah.
Now recently, we've seen some news about space and ISIS and how we might be directing the fight towards ISIS. Tell me a little bit about more about that.
Right. So Washington Post recently came out with an article that talked about the Joint Interagency Combined Space Operations Center, which is, I guess, in military acronym terms, JIXPOC, which sounds just a really awful acronym to use. But it essentially talks about a very recent effort directed in the past 4 to 5 years, which essentially talks about the integration of space-based elements in the fight against symmetric and asymmetric threats. So what that means on the ground, at least based on what Secretary of Defense Ash Carter has told us, is a lot of wargaming, which is primarily going to be the symmetric component.
Mm-hmm.
And then also asymmetric components to counter ISIS, most notably. And in the article, Ash Carter talks about primarily counter-encryption efforts. Now, really, this is a kind of gets into the general counter-encryption debate or encryption debate. And it's one I think the government typically overplays.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's obviously all classified, but the counter-encryption efforts, I'm even more trepid about kind of postulating on, because in recent debates, encryption efforts have really democratized quite a bit.
Certainly.
And even, you know, all it takes is going on your iPhone and downloading an app like WhatsApp or...
Which recently just went all encrypted.
Which recently this month went end-to-end encryption. And as far as I know, and I'm not an encryption expert, we at least don't have any major end-to-end counter-encryption efforts that are in the public kind of knowledge. So,
for good reason.
Right. So when he talks about that, it's difficult to say. But I really think that the key point there is that DoD recognizes that future conflicts in the symmetric realm will include space on a more kind of key offensive offensive nature than previously, and so it's interesting to see how that might play in. I know that National Reconnaissance Office, the NSA, CIA, assuming the other DNI elements, will all play a role in getting this information to our warfighters, but also countering what might occur on an
right,
adversary's level.
Right. So what else is going on in space? I know we were talking about a few issues a little earlier.
Sure. So I guess one of the bigger trends that you'll see in the headlines most recently, and one that's kind of takes up actually much of the headlines, is the role of commercial elements. And as you might know, SpaceX has now landed its second first stage booster on an autonomous sea-based drone. They have one more test, which is essentially going to go from full velocity. But that is going to play a significant role just in how we do business in space.
So what do you mean? Can you elaborate on that a bit? I mean, what are the implications of a reusable rocket?
Sure. So I think the primary implications, at least what SpaceX would have you to believe, is from an economic standpoint. I believe SpaceX talks around $40 million per launch, as opposed to $200 million, which is currently currently kind of our de facto method. Now, from a national security standpoint, it's resiliency is the kind of name of the game in terms of how we launch satellites and how, in terms of A, how secure future missions are, but B, also how responsive are we to missed capabilities in the event of something catastrophic.
Right.
And both of those are important components in generating resiliency for our space-based program. And it's really what DoD is trying to focus on in terms of how we build up a future space architecture.
So what do you mean by resiliency in terms of space?
Sure. So it is, as I mentioned, security in terms of our future missions, because obviously the time horizon of our space missions extend out close to a decade, if not more in some instances, but also how we respond to incidents in space, either just a satellite malfunctioning to the point where it can no longer efficiently function, or if, you know, worst of worst cases, something either man-made or natural, that's kind of less likely, affects the capabilities, whether it's taking out a satellite, taking out a, you know,
back to the ASAT issue.
Yeah, it's things like that. As I mentioned, we rely on these capabilities in essentially all, in most, if not all, of our war fighting kind of efforts. And even a small missed capability can have outsized impacts depending on kind of what the specific system that is affected is. And if we don't have the proper, if we don't have an architecture that can either respond to that threat and kind of pick up the slack, then it can have real impacts on, you know, on our warfighters, on our communications efforts, on stability, and then in the maybe nuclear realm, things of that nature.
Certainly. So what else is going on in the world with, or I should say outside of the world in space?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I've been looking at recently, and this is kind of a longer arc issue, is are we effectively countering the militarization of space with cooperative, typically civilian efforts? I think a rough proxy here is to look at national security missions and most frequently NASA missions,
mm-hmm.
and whether there is kind of a growing discrepancy between the two. It's my thesis that there is, both from a budgetary standpoint, but also just in terms of what's in the public interest, what is our policy standpoint from a civilian government standpoint. And things of that nature.
So how does that mix when you're talking about you know, in terms of national security, when you're dealing with the civilian side of things, say, you know, ISS, or maybe even, you know, sending our astronauts to Russia or Kazakhstan to take trips up to the station, or dealing with purely military space technologies?
Sure. So I think I always like to go back to kind of the cornerstones of international efforts in space and how we've cooperated with both adversaries but also allies, and the effect that has had. The cornerstone, as you mentioned, is ISS, an effort that includes more than a handful of international agents, And kind of the most notable relationship between and that example is Russia and the United States. As some of our audience might be aware, currently the only way that we have assured manned access to space is through the Russian Soyuz program. Despite everything that has occurred in Ukraine, despite the failure of kind of the Russian reset, ISS has been a continued example of international cooperation. Now,
and how did we get to this point? I mean, why are we relying on the Russians to get, you know, Americans? I mean, we're the first country that landed on, we're the only country that's landed on the moon. Why are we relying on the Russians to get us into space at this point?
Essentially, as of right now, it is that we retired the space shuttle program. That is the short answer. I think it kind of goes back to a public interest and effort argument here, in that we do really well in terms of space when one of two things occurs. Either we respond to an external event, you know, the most notable example being Sputnik, or there is significant public interest, both from a civilian and civilian policymaker standpoint, in space. And I think we are lacking both of those. I don't think that a Sputnik moment can occur in the 21st century, at least unless Russia were to make significant gains towards putting humans on Mars. I think that would be the only kind of Sputnik moment that could occur.
I think they're a little behind the game
right,
on that.
Right, right. So I don't think that's going to occur.
Do you think there's possibly avenues for cooperation for future Mars missions? I mean, I know we're not necessarily planning on bringing Russians along for the first landing or two, but you know, after that, do you think, you know, geopolitics permitting, that there's an opportunity for cooperation on future missions?
I would really hope so. You know, we still have so much to figure out about getting to Mars, and certain gains have been made. SpaceX is planning on putting an unmanned Dragon 2 capsule on Mars in 2018. Now, I'm not sure whether that timeline will line up, but that would be the most notable advance of recent years or perhaps ever. And I would really hope that international efforts took place, whether it is the establishment of a base, whether it is figuring out some of the more kind of scientific aspects of how you deal with longer term missions to space and how the effect on the human body, which some of which we're doing on the ISS and international collaborative experiments. But I think it should, if it doesn't need to, then it definitely should concern an international aspect, because once the ISS is retired and the specific date of that is still up for debate. Russia is kind of the one who has made the most public stance on what's the next step in terms of international cooperation in space. The United States has been a little more reserved about how they interact with the Russians in terms of this big international kind of keystone effort. But I think the Mars mission is the area that has the most potential here, more so than whatever the next step of the ISS or whatever we call it is.
Well, you tend to learn more by going places than staying in a single spot.
Well, and it's also a matter of garnering public support. A second generation space station would be inherently an iterative effort rather than a revolutionary effort. And we see public interest wane when it's an iterative effort in space, even if it's not really an iterative effort, or it's at least a very significant iterative effort, like some of the kind of imaging efforts we're doing with New Horizons and things of that nature. Those are big steps for space development, but they don't garner the same attention as A, manned programs, or B, just doing entirely new things.
Well, do you think there are any sort of, you know, key things that could pop up that could really increase that public interest to the level that it should be, whether that's on the national security side or the exploration side?
I think it would have to be with the Mars program. Even when we look at super long-term ARC programs, that like the recently announced Starshot project, which is an effort to send small light sail-based spacecraft to Alpha Centauri, which is our nearest solar system.
About 4 light years away.
Right. I don't see that having the same public support as a Mars mission. It just doesn't. It doesn't have the same appeal. As much as it might be an incredibly cool project, at least in my mind as a space nerd, it can't garner the same public support, and it won't garner the same public policy support. Right. So I think it is a matter of making advances to the Mars mission. Yeah.
So, Aiden, what do you think, you know, in terms of the next 15 to 20 years, you know, what are you most hopeful about, and what are you most worried about?
Sure. What I'm most worried about is that we don't increase information sharing capabilities between various nations, which is kind of one of the more routine cooperative elements that we can kind of really take advantage of. We have not sufficiently built up information capabilities in terms of space. If even unintended conflicts were to occur, we don't have sufficient targeting capabilities in space. We don't have enough information from, particularly from nations like China, who are really trying to establish their space kind of program right now. And to be sure, they don't have the exact same strategic mindset as we do for these capabilities. They're still advancing in terms of their space program. They're still trying to build up capabilities, while we're really focused on assured access to space. We're really focused on making sure that our warfighters on the ground have sufficient targeting capabilities, sufficient communications capabilities, reconnaissance capabilities, things of that nature. So there are differences in our strategic mindset, but that is not to say that a significant potential exists for information sharing capabilities that can prevent unintended consequences from occurring if
the classic security dilemma.
Right. It's an unstable environment in a way that doesn't have to be because we don't share enough information. And it's not a matter of sharing intelligence. It's not a matter of doing those sorts of things. It's just getting basic information about where our satellites are, what they're doing, and what they're doing is an area that's really, we really have underwhelming kind of treaties on. Not to say mm-hmm. that treaties are, you know, the most successful generally, but a lot of, you know, when we talk about the X-37B, which is a reusable space plane or, that our Air Force has taken over, we don't know what it's doing. It's testing. That's what they say, but
we don't know what it's testing.
We don't know what it's testing. We don't know if that's really the primary or if it's the only mission there. And that exists from a number of standpoints, from a number of nations. And our Outer Space Treaty, which is kind of the main treaty that we talk about when we talk about international cooperation in space, doesn't have sufficient provisions for that. It allows for quote-unquote passive military operations, so things like reconnaissance, things like that. But the reporting mechanism that's in place is really insufficient and typically not adhered to. Now, what I'm most hopeful for is a major effort like something like Mars or things like that that can increase kind of cooperative keystone elements of our space program, and I think it is big enough that we can get public support, assuming that we put in a little bit of time. I think one of the main roadblocks is that, you know, NASA funding has continually gone down since the mid to late 1960s, And a lot of that was because in the during that period of time, we were building up the Apollo program. But it has since kind of decreased and decreased. And if we kind of generate specific major initiatives in that realm, I think that we could get public support in there, and it would drive up funding significantly. And I really hope that it would include an international cooperative element, because it is the combination of information sharing and civilian-based exploration elements are two easy ways to get diplomacy done in space. You don't have to take on some of the bigger projects like trying to do a treaty relating to anti-satellite weapons or things like that. Let's get those early elements done that are much easier to stomach from a kind of conservative, hawkish perspective on the role of space in future conflicts.
The smaller steps before the one large step.
Right, right.
Aiden, that's all we have time for today, but I'd like to thank you for coming in and speaking to us.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
For ASP, this is Matthew Wolf. Thanks very much.